This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Welcome to the program. If you're a regular listener, thanks for listening and welcome back. If you're a new listener, this is where we talk about what's going on in the economy and what it might mean for you and your money, and we attempt to give you some hands-on strategies for you to consider as well. Joining me in just about a minute or so will be my special guest expert for this week, Mr. Todd Knoop. We'll get his take on what's going on around the world in different economies, in particular China. And is China's economy experiencing a slowdown, and will we feel it here in the United States? It'll be a great discussion. Also on today's program, I'll be talking about the managed risk strategy, a strategy that we talk about in detail at our new retirement rules class, and we're going to give you a preview of that strategy in segments 2 and 4 today on the program. So if you know of somebody that's retiring or managing a nest egg, give them a call, let them know we're talking about it, get a pen and paper out and get ready to take some notes. We'll give you some good information. And speaking of good information, if you'd like to attend our new retirement rules class or get more information, all you have to do is visit the website, newretirementrules.com. The website, again, is newretirementrules.com. I am pleased to have, as a first-time guest here on Everything Financial Radio, Professor Todd A. Knoop, who is the David Joyce Professor of Economics and Business at Cornell College. Todd is the author of multiple articles as well as books. His most recent book, Business Cycle Economics, Understanding Recessions and Depressions from Boom to Bust, is right up the alley of many of our listeners. We're excited to have him on the program. And Todd, welcome.
Thank you very much, Dennis. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Todd, let's start with just the premise of your book, Understanding Recessions and Depressions from Boom to Bust. I should say the subtitle of your book. Understanding recessions and depressions in these cycles would certainly be something that would be very handy for many of our listeners. Is it possible to understand and predict these cycles?
Prediction, probably not. You know, it's been said that an economist is somebody who can tell you why something happened after it happened. And I think that's basically true about business cycles, is that business cycles remain very, very difficult to predict. And I think part of the reason that that is that business cycles are not the same. And in fact, really this terminology of using a business cycle is really a misnomer, because a business cycle kind of indicates that it's something regular and predictable. And in fact, business cycles are somewhat irregular. They're very unpredictable. I think they're caused by many different sorts of phenomena. I think that a lot of people, both on the left and the right of the political spectrum, have interesting things to say, and actually quite appropriate things to say about business cycles. And so it's not, you know, it's an issue that doesn't boil down to a simple yes, no, black, white, this always is responsible for this kind of scenario. It's actually very complex. There's a lot of nuance, and so that's, of course, one of the reasons why I'm interested in it, is because it seems like there's always more to learn and more to understand.
So, Todd, give me your perspective on an opinion on cycles, economic cycles. Do you believe that economic cycles repeat themselves?
Well, they do. They do. But as I said, you know, they don't repeat themselves in predictable ways, you know? You know, it's been said, you might have heard this quote before, but that the most expensive words in finance is that this time it's different, right? And that's one of the things we see about business cycles, is that particularly as it pertains to these asset bubbles, usually when the bubble is building, there's people out there saying, no, this time it's different. History doesn't repeat itself. And then we step back a few years later, and in fact we see that history does repeat itself, maybe not in quite the same ways, right? There might be subtle differences, but in practice, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of repetition through history. And, you know, so yeah, I mean, one thing that we can be certain of is that there will be another business cycle. There will be another financial crisis. It's just a question of when and where.
Yeah, when you were speaking, Todd, I was reminded of the book written by Reinhardt and Roghoff, and the title was This Time is Different. So certainly that's been an oft-repeated phrase. Let me ask you this. Given the current economic conditions. We had an asset bubble in real estate that built and burst. Are you seeing that there are asset bubbles that exist now based upon your research?
Well, I don't particularly see an asset bubble in any U.S. asset markets at this point. But, I think there's also there's a lot to be worried about in foreign markets. Particularly one of the things that economists are very worried about is what's happening in China. While there's some evidence that the real estate bubble in China has been deflating a little bit, real estate prices and other asset prices in China are extremely high. And, another thing that's going on in China is that there's a lot of debt in China. We think about China as lending us money. But if you look at the details, there's a lot of debt, personal debt, local government debt in China. And so that's a threat to the U.S. economy to the extent that, the Chinese and U.S. economies are inexorably linked. A financial crisis in China would have big impacts on what would happen here in the U.S. And so while I'm not predicting anything, here in the next 3 months or 6 months, I think it's something that investors and all Americans should keep an eye on, is that we just can't ignore what's going on in places like China.
Let's talk about China, Todd. It's interesting you brought that up. And if you're just joining us, we are chatting with Todd Knoop, who is author of the book Business Cycle Economics, Understanding Recessions and Depressions from Boom to Bust. I'd encourage you to check it out. I'm sure it's available on Amazon. Todd, talk about what's going on in China, because as you said, a lot of people think China is the largest creditor nation on earth, which is true. But when you look at personal debt and local government debt, it's quite high. And are we seeing China's real estate market now starting to implode, similar to what we saw in the United States not that long ago?
Possibly. One of the things that's been happening in China is that the government and the Central Bank of China have been trying to gradually let some of the air out of the bubble, right? So they've been tightening up lending standards. They've been gradually raising interest rates to try to reduce the provision of credit. But, what's going on in China, it's a very complex system, because basically the formal banking system is all orientated toward giving finance to these big state-owned corporations, where very little of actual economic growth in China is occurring. Most private companies get their lending from informal markets, right? From people that they know, from, these kind of backyard markets where, people know somebody who knows somebody who's willing to become an investor. And that's all fine and good, but the problem is that we don't really know what's going on in those markets, right? It's very difficult to figure out exactly what kind of risk that people are exposed to. We don't even know what kind of risk the big banks in China are exposed to, because while they might lend to these state-owned enterprises, the state-owned enterprises oftentimes turn around and lend it to private individuals. So it's an incredibly convoluted system that, quite honestly, I don't think anybody really has a great grasp for, including the Chinese government. And so while, as I said, they're trying to, gradually let a little bit of the air out of the bubble, there's always a question about whether they're going to be able to do that appropriately and whether there's some shock out there that would really expose the system for the somewhat convoluted mess that it is.
So, Todd, we've got about a little over a minute left. Assuming that China's economy has the proverbial hard landing, how will U.S. investors be affected?
Well, U.S. investors would probably be impacted in many more ways than they could possibly imagine, or even I could possibly imagine, in the sense that, obviously there's a demand for U.S. goods in China. So we think about the traditional import and export channels. But then there's all sorts of other ways that the U.S. economy and the Chinese economy are linked. One of the big ways is that, of course, the Chinese government buys U.S. bonds, right? And so if the demand for those bonds dry up, that could lead to higher interest rates in the U.S. There's also all sorts of financial linkages in that U.S. banks and many U.S. citizens through their 401k accounts are invested in China, and so either directly or indirectly through international corporations. And so if the Chinese economy begins to slump, that's going to affect returns on all these international corporations. And so, you know, it's, you know, not to cop out on your question, but it's really such, there's such a complex web of linkages between the U.S. and China that, you know, it's very difficult to predict what will happen, other than the fact that, yes, certainly U.S. investors are going to be impacted quite significantly if there is a bust in China.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today is Professor Todd Knoop, who is the David Joyce Professor of Economics and Business at Cornell College. His book is Business Cycle Economics, Understanding Recessions and Depressions from Boom to Bust, and we'll continue our conversation with him when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. You know, in this particular segment, I want to talk today about some alternate strategies that you might consider for your nest egg, given that we believe we're in an economic winter season. Now, a lot of financial professionals out there use what I like to call the one bucket approach to managing a nest egg. Well, what is the one bucket approach? Well, the one bucket approach typically has all your assets in stocks and bonds, or stock mutual funds and bond mutual funds. And the old rule of thumb used by a lot of financial professionals is that the older you are, the more money you should have in bonds. And certainly that can be a strategy that can work well in many circumstances, but it's our belief that moving ahead, that one bucket approach might not work very well. Why? Well, if interest rates today are at low levels, which I believe we can all agree that interest rates are at low levels, the next logical move in interest rates will be for interest rates to move higher. When that happens, what will happen to the value of a bond fund? Well, bond funds and interest rates move inversely or in opposite directions. So if a bond fund were to decline in value, it would mean that interest rates were going up, or in a cause and effect type relationship, as interest rates go up, bond funds decline. As far as stocks, it's our view that the stock market at this point is likely ready for a correction. Now, it may not be this month or even this year, but when you take a look at a number of technical and fundamental indicators, this market is likely overvalued again, in our opinion. You'll certainly find folks that will disagree with that. So in this segment, I want to talk about how do you potentially take some of this downside risk and attempt to control it to a little greater extent. And the example that I always like to use is, if you like to go to the casino, and maybe you do, maybe you don't, but if you do go to the casino, my guess is you decide in advance how much money you're willing to lose. You only put $50 in your wallet, and when that money's gone, you quit gambling. You don't put all your capital at risk. You don't have all your capital or all your assets in play, and yet a lot of folks who use the one-bucket approach to managing their nest egg have all their assets in play. They have theoretically all their assets at risk. So I want to give you a strategy that you might consider, and let me say before I start that this strategy is not going to work for everybody. It may not be right for you, and I'm going to talk purely about this strategy in a hypothetical sense. Now, the strategy I want to talk about is something called the manage risk strategy. And the objective of the manage risk strategy are to protect assets and achieve a 0 to maybe 20% growth rate each year. We don't want to lose money. Now, let me say that there's no guarantee that this objective will be achieved, but if you could get a 0 to 20% return every year and possibly take the risk of losing money off the table, is that something that might make sense? Well, let me explain this managed risk strategy to you again hypothetically, and I'll give you a hypothetical example. Let's take the example of Jack. Jack has $65,000 invested in an index fund, and we'll just call this hypothetical fund XYZ Fund. Now, an index fund, for those of you that are not aware or maybe aren't familiar with that term, is typically an unmanaged fund based on a market index. So the index fund will typically attempt to get about the same return as a market index by buying all the stocks in a particular index. Well, Jack, in this example, again, has $65,000 invested in an index fund, and we'll call this index fund, as we said, XYZ Fund. And Jack has 500 shares of XYZ Fund, and the share price is $130. So take 500 shares times $130, and that's Jack's $65,000 balance. Now, if the related market index were to decline by 50% while Jack owns this index fund, Jack would likely find that his investment would decline by about 50%. On the other hand, if the related index were to appreciate by 50%, Jack's probably going to be a happy guy. Jack's going to find that his investment would also appreciate by about 50%. When Jack has some of his assets invested in an index fund, theoretically speaking, 100% of his assets are at risk. Now, indexes typically don't decline 100%, but he's got 100% of his capital in play. Now, as we have discussed, it's our opinion that in an economic winter environment, this could be risky. Now, rather than have 100% of his capital in play in XYZ Fund, what if Jack decides to take his $65,000 and go out and purchase individual corporate bonds? Now, we don't want Jack to buy bond funds because, as I talked about at the onset of this segment, if interest rates go up or rise, bond funds will go down or decline. So the corporate bonds that Jack buys are individual bonds. He buys them on the secondary market, and he ladders the maturity date. And now when I say Jack is going to ladder the maturity date, he's going to have some coming due in maybe 2 years, some coming due in 3 years, some coming due in 4 years. When CDs were more popular because they had better yields than they have today, a lot of folks would ladder maturities on CDs. So we're going to do the same thing here with bonds, and there's going to be some criteria that we're going to use to select our bonds. So don't go right out and try to implement this strategy because you heard it on the radio program today. There are a lot of moving parts, and there's some due diligence that you need to do to make this work. However, it's important to understand that there may be strategies out there other than the one bucket approach that you can use to manage your assets that might allow you to get a 0 to 20% return every year and take the downside potentially out of play. Well, Jack decides which bonds he'll buy, and he diversifies his holdings, and he buys no more than 5 bonds in any one company. Now, bonds are typically denominated in increments of $1,000, so Jack goes out and buys bonds issued by 12 different companies. That theoretically further reduces his risk because Jack has diversified. Now, in this hypothetical example, let's assume that Jack realizes an average yield to maturity on his bond portfolio of 4%. That means that Jack will earn interest of about $2,600 annually on his portfolio of $65,000. Now, it's important to also understand that the value of these bonds can fluctuate between the time Jack buys them and maturity, but provided that company is in business at maturity and is capable of paying off the bond, paying off the loan essentially that you've made to the company, Jack knows what his return will be exactly from the time he buys it until the maturity date. So it's important that Jack is able to hold these bonds to maturity. Well, Jack likes the safety of his portfolio because now if the stock market crashes or corrects, Jack's not going to participate. However, Jack would like to have the opportunity to get returns that are greater than the 4% interest that he's earning on his bond portfolio. Well, that's all the time I have in this segment to talk about how this strategy works, but I'll be picking up the conversation again in the fourth segment of today's program, so you'll want to stay tuned for that. If you would like to learn more about alternate strategies you might consider, you might also consider attending our new retirement rules class. We have a class coming up on April the 25th. You can get more information about the class or register while capacity remains. You can do that online at the website newretirementrules.com. The website again is newretirementrules.com. I'll be back after these words. Stay with me.
Give me your money, just give me my.
is Everything Financial Radio. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the distinct pleasure of chatting today with Todd A. Noop. Todd is the David Joyce Professor of Economics and Business at Cornell College. His book is Business Cycle Economics, Understanding Recessions and Depressions from Boom to Bust. So, Todd, let me just jump in and ask a fairly broad question. Define what causes, in your view, as you study history, recessions and depressions.
Well, I think there's kind of two big ideas or two big causes of recessions and depressions. And then, you know, underneath these big ideas is lots of kind of smaller concepts that are related. But, you know, one kind of recession is the demand-driven recession, right, where demand drives up because of, you know, some sort of loss of confidence in the economy, or whether it's because government is forced to raise taxes or forced to cut its spending. And so these kind of depressions, I think, are well understood by economists. Also another source of demand-driven recessions would be those associated with financial crises, right, that you have an asset bubble like a housing market or a stock market. When prices go down, people lose their wealth, and then they stop spending. Then the other kind of recession is the more supply-driven recession, and that, you know, a good example of this would be what occurred in the United States in the 1970s, right, when the price of oil went up dramatically. And so there it wasn't a question of having enough demand for goods. It was really a question of the cost of making these goods, and that really constricted production and, you know, led to an overall decline in output. So, you know, but underneath those two kind of big theories, there's a lot of other things that you have to understand in order to really have a full understanding of business cycles. You know, one of the most important is how financial markets work, right? I think one of the things that economists have learned here over the last 10 or 20 years is just how important the role that financial markets play in propagating business cycles and actually making them bigger than they would otherwise be, either because of banking crises, which, you know, makes it difficult for people to borrow and lend and spend money, whether because of asset bubbles, when they pop, people reduce wealth, or financial markets also play an important role in the economy and in just things like people's confidence, people's overall confidence. And so, you know, there's a lot of things going on in financial markets, and economists kind of very slowly are trying to separate out these individual threads and trying to make it into somewhat of a coherent whole. And, you know, we've had some success, but I certainly don't want to proclaim that we're ready to say we understand everything, or that we're definitely not ready to predict the future, the next crisis, because, as I said before, economists are notoriously bad at that. I don't think I have to tell your listeners that economists aren't very good at prediction.
So, Todd, let me ask a question as it relates to some of the conversations I've had with other guests here on the Everything Financial Radio program. To what extent would you say private sector debt levels contribute to these economic and business cycles?
I think they can play a very big role. And, you know, I think they play a role in, because they contribute to that financial instability that we talked about. You know, one of the regular things, you know, the empirical regularities that we see in business cycles is that while there's kind of a boom and bust in output, there's also kind of a boom and bust in credit and debt, right? And that usually what we see before a recession occurs is we see that it's usually preceded by a lot of confidence, a lot of cheap credit, and a lot of debt, and that debt can be debt accumulated by the government, and then, of course, that debt can be debt that's accumulated by private individuals. And so, you know, we see that the boom and bust cycle in the economy as a whole kind of, you know, follows the boom and bust cycle in credit and debt, but with a lag. And so, yeah, I think that's one of the things that that intelligent investors should pay close attention to, is, you know, looking at overall debt levels and trying to put it in some perspective. You know, as I said before, you know, the most expensive words in finance are "this time it's different." And in 2006 and 2007 in the U.S., you heard a lot of people making that case that this time it's different, that the buildup in private debt in the U.S., it wasn't, you know, the numbers that you saw that were way outside of historical norms. A lot of people were arguing that they didn't matter because there's all these new financial instruments. You know, there's things like derivatives that really make, you know, somehow make risk, the risk associated with debt disappear. And, you know, now we can look back at those arguments and see them as, you know, somewhat silly. But, you know, that's a recurring phenomenon, that people want to see things as different when, in fact, we regularly see that the buildup of debt is one of the things that leads up to the buildup before a crisis.
So, Todd, let me ask you, because I've had guests on the program who point out the fact that, in their view, another financial crisis is likely. In some cases, I've had guests say their view is imminent. And that's due to the fact that the too-big-to-fail banks are now bigger. And you mentioned derivatives. Derivative exposure with these too-big-to-fail banks is now greater than it was prior to the financial crisis. What would your opinion be in that area?
Well, I guess I would classify myself as somebody who doesn't see a financial crisis in the U.S. is imminent. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. The biggest is, it is true that exposure to things like derivatives are higher now than they were even before the crisis. But it's also true that banks are forced to hold a lot more capital than they were before the crisis. And so the overall balance sheet position of most banks is a lot less risky, in my opinion, than it was before the crisis. And so, no, I don't consider myself to be somebody who thinks that the next crisis is imminent, though, of course, I certainly believe that there will be another crisis one day. I just hope it's not hope it's not very soon.
So, Todd, let me ask your opinion on U.S. stock market indices. Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned that it was your view that you don't really see any asset price bubbles in the U.S. Would you say that opinion would also encompass stocks, and how would you say there's no asset bubble in stocks, given that, you know, PEs, at least trailing PEs, are at near historical high levels?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I guess in part the question depends upon what do you call, you know, what are we going to call a bubble? Do I believe it's possible that stocks are looking at a correction here in the near future? Yes. I mean, I think that there's a lot of good evidence that suggests that a correction is going to occur. But do I expect that correction to be 20 to 40%? No, I don't. And once again, that's just kind of basically based on the idea that we don't see those measures of things like price-earnings ratio out of line with historical averages by that much, right? So they are out of line with historical averages, but not by as much as I would expect to see if we had a true bubble with a massive correction. But yes, I think there is a chance that, you know, we could be looking at kind of a more short-term downturn, if that makes any sense, as opposed to the kind of long-term correction in which the market would be going down for 9 months at a time and total values would fall more than 20%.
Todd, let me get your view on long-term U.S. Treasuries. We've seen the yield on the 30-year U.S. Treasury go as low as about 2.5%, been hovering between, you know, 2.5% and 2.75% for most of the year. Would yields that low indicate to you that we have a bubble in U.S. Treasuries?
I don't believe so. I guess there's a couple of reasons for that belief. First off, yields are higher than they have been over the last couple of years. But I think the fundamental reason is that I don't particularly see a bubble, is that a big part of the reason why yields are so low is because the U.S. is still seen as such an attractive place to invest by foreign savers. And as the world economy booms, as emerging market economies continue to have relatively strong growth, there's a lot of savings that's looking for a home, and that home continues to be the U.S. And I think that is a big part of the reason why yields are so low right now. Now, having said there's no bubble, do I believe that there's risk in treasuries? Very much. very much because, you know, as I talked about a few minutes ago, there's real risk in the global financial system, particularly with some of the things that are going on with China. And so, you know, if there was a dramatic slowdown in China, that's going to dramatically impact U.S. interest rates, in part because Chinese won't be buying our bonds, but also in part because a slowdown in China is almost certainly going to adversely affect every other economy in the globe. And we typically see when economies slow down, interest rates go down. So, you know, well, I don't see it, just to repeat, I don't see a bubble. I do see a fair amount of risk in treasuries.
Well, Todd, we've got maybe a minute and a half left here or so. You mentioned China. Is there any place else in the world, any other country where you're seeing evidence of a business slump or maybe a low in an economic cycle?
Well, of course, Europe continues to be a real weight around the neck of the U.S. economy. Europe is one of our largest trading partners, and the fact that Europe has not been able to put this debt crisis behind it continues to be a real drag for what's happening in our economy. And so, you know, I think that's something that U.S. investors have to pay a lot of attention to. And, you know, I think the economics are a lot simpler than the politics of what's going on. And so that makes it also kind of a scary situation for investors is that, you know, politics are often difficult to predict. But having said, you know, talked about the worries, the dangers of China and Europe, you know, there's also a lot of good news in the global economy. And, you know, one of the areas that I see a lot of good news is in less developed countries that are rapidly growing and soon to be emerging market economies. And in these countries, I include places that U.S. investors typically don't look to, such as sub-Saharan Africa, right? There's a number of countries that are doing very well there. And so, you know, one hope for the U.S. investor and for the U.S. and for global markets in general is that, you know, the relative strength of places that have been historically very weak holds promise and it holds a safe haven for investors who want to have a more balanced portfolio.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Professor Todd Knoop. Todd is the David Joyce Professor of Economics and Business at Cornell College. His book, I'd encourage you to check out, Business Cycle Economics, Understanding Recessions and Depressions from Boom to Bust. Todd, enjoyed the conversation very much today. Love to have you back.
Great. Thank you for having me, Dennis. I really appreciate it.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you're with me today, and we are talking about alternate strategies. And previously on the Everything Financial Radio program, we started to talk about something called the Manage Risk Strategy. And I want to spend a little bit more time talking about that and give you the rest of the strategy in this segment. If you weren't with us previously, let me give you just a little bit of background about the strategy. We talked about the fact that many financial professionals utilize what I like to call a one-bucket approach to managing a nest egg. That one-bucket approach has really all your assets in one bucket, and in that bucket, you have stocks and bonds or stock funds and mutual funds. And there's an old rule of thumb that is still embraced by many in the financial industry that the older you are, the greater percentage of assets that you should have in bonds. However, we believe there are potentially a couple inherent problems with this one-bucket approach. First of all, interest rates, I think we can all agree, are at historically low levels. When interest rates move up, the value of bond funds will decline. They move inversely or in opposite directions. And we've had many guests here on the Everything Financial Radio program over the past several months that agree with our assessment, and to be fair, some don't, but many agree with our assessment that this market is likely overvalued and a correction is likely. If that's the case, you could see both asset classes, both stocks and bonds, or stock funds and bond funds, decline in value during this winter season. And we talked about the fact previously that if you go to the casino, you'll likely decide in advance how much money you're willing to lose. You don't have all your assets out there in play. And yet, a lot of folks, when it comes to managing their assets using this one bucket approach, they have all their assets in play. All their assets are at risk. So what the manage risk strategy does is attempts to mitigate some of that risk. And the goal of the manage risk strategy is to make from a 0 to 20% return every year while controlling or mitigating the downside. Well, previously we talked about the fact that Jack, our hypothetical investor, has $65,000 invested in an index fund that we called XYZ Fund. He owned 500 shares of XYZ Fund at a share price of $130. Now, Jack took the money out of the index fund and decided to go buy a laddered portfolio of individual corporate bonds, not bond funds. Now, Jack has an average yield of maturity that he will likely realize on his bond portfolio of about 4% if all these companies are in business at maturity. It's important also to note that in this hypothetical example, I am not taking into account what fees Jack might pay to buy the bonds. I'm not taking into account that the value of the bonds may fluctuate if Jack needs to sell them prior to maturity. There are several moving parts here, so keep in mind this is a hypothetical example. Jack, however, likes the safety of his portfolio since now, because he owns individual corporate bonds, he's insulated himself from a stock market crash. However, Jack isn't really crazy about the 4% return he's getting on his bond portfolio. So here's where the manage risk strategy might benefit Jack. Jack should consider combining this strategy of buying highly rated corporate bonds with a strategy that uses the interest he earns on his bond portfolio to buy call options on the exchange-traded fund that he used to own. So basically, we're going to take the interest that Jack will earn on his bond portfolio and use it to buy options on the exchange-traded fund that he used to own. Now, to be fair, you can't buy options on every exchange-traded fund. Again, this is a hypothetical example. Now, when I mention options, when it comes to buying options, the only thing that many investors have heard is that options are risky. Maybe even they've heard they're very risky. Stay away from them. Well, that can be true, but it's not always true. If you were to sell options to an investor, meaning you collected money for the sale, your risk could be significant. However, if you buy an option, your maximum risk is the amount of money that you paid for the option. Now, I can probably best explain options by using a real estate analogy with which you may be familiar. Let's say there's a piece of property that you really want to own, but the owner doesn't want to sell it. Well, you might consider offering to buy an option on the property from the property owner. You'd give the owner of the property some money, and in exchange, the owner would grant you a first right of refusal to buy the property should the owner ever decide to sell it. Should the owner ever decide to sell the property, you would have the option to buy the property, but you wouldn't be obligated to make the purchase. Call options on an exchange-traded fund or on a stock work in a very similar manner. You part with some money, and in exchange, you receive an option to buy a specified number of shares, in this example, of an exchange-traded fund, at a predetermined price, provided you do so prior to an expiration date. So let me summarize. There are three components when buying a call option: the predetermined price at which the security can be purchased, the number of shares that you can purchase, and the expiration date. So let's go back to our example. Let's assume Jack wants to buy some call options on XYZ Fund. Since the current share price is $130 per share, Jack decides that his strike price, the predetermined purchase price, will be $130 a share. Jack discovers he can buy a call option on one share of XYZ Fund expiring in 6 months for $5.60 a share, or he could buy a call option with the same strike price of $130 per share with an expiration date of 12 months for $8.10 a share. Well, one option contract allows the buyer to control 100 shares. So if you had 100 shares or one contract with $130 strike price expiring in 6 months, Jack has to part with $560. That's $5.60 per share times 100 shares. If you wanted a one-year expiration date, he's going to part with $810. Now, both contracts will allow Jack to purchase 100 shares of XYZ Fund at $130 a share. One contract expires in 6 months, and the other one expires in 12 months. Let's just say, for example, Jack decides to buy the contract that expires in a year. And let's just say that prior to this one-year expiration date, let's assume XYZ Fund went to $160 per share. Jack could then go out and exercise his option to buy shares of XYZ Fund at $130 a share and simultaneously sell them for $160 a share. Jack makes whatever that profit is minus the cost of the option. If, however, Jack took all the interest he would earn from the bond portfolio and bought options and the shares of XYZ declined prior to a year, Jack wouldn't exercise his option. He would just get a 0% return for that particular year. So that, in essence, is how the managed risk strategy works. We talk about this strategy in detail at our new retirement rules class. If you'd like to get more information on the class or register, you can go to the website, newretirementrules.com. There's class information that is posted there on the website at newretirementrules.com. And on the right-hand side of the screen, there is a place to register. The cost for the class is just $49. That's a cost for you and a guest. It includes the cost of the handouts, the book, and a lunch that you and your guest will get at the class. The next class will be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. That's in Grand Rapids. It will be on Saturday, April 25. It will begin at 9 a.m. It will conclude at 2:30 p.m. The class is beginning to fill up and get close to reaching capacity. So if you'd like to attend, I would encourage you to go to the New Retirement Rules website right away. Again, the web address is newretirementrules.com, and check it out or register. If you'd like to listen to any of our interviews with our guest experts again, all you have to do is go to the iTunes store. You can download those interviews in the form of podcasts for free. Just search under Everything Financial Radio. That's our program for this week. Glad you decided to tune in. We'll be here again next week, same time. Bye.